Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, and today my guest is Stephen Markley. Stephen is a writer and author of two critically acclaimed novels. His debut, Ohio, is set in a small Rust Belt town and follows four former classmates who've returned home to grapple with their troubled past. His most recent work is the epic, sprawling, beautiful novel, The Deluge, which takes place in an America where the realities of climate change are becoming all too real as humanity struggles to navigate and survive in an uncertain world. I really enjoyed both of these novels, but Stephen and I started our conversation discussing his work in Hollywood as a member of the writer's room on the hit TV show Only Murders in the Building.
Stephen, I'm someone who also has kind of dipped into television writing a bit and has found some joys and frustrations in it as it goes. How are you kind of taking to it so far?
You know, I kind of pot committed to it. I moved out to Los Angeles in order to pursue it. And, you know, I wrote on Only Murders in the Building and I had a blast doing it. It was during the pandemic, so it was all on Zoom. And like everybody in the room was so funny. I'm still friends with all of them. And so it was terrific. At the same time, you know, as a novelist, I'm the tyrant of my writing. I get to decide everything. And so learning to work in a group where, you know, you're tossing out some suggestion that you like stayed up all night working on, and then it's like, we're going to go in this other direction. That's tough. And so learning like sort of that collaborative process is something I'm still in the midst of, as well as just like, you know, in publishing, it's like you have the editor and you have the publisher and you have like a few people who have to say yes. In Hollywood, it's like the number of people who have to say yes to your idea is just sort of staggering. And I think that is definitely a frustration. I don't know, is that what you found or is it similar or different?
Yeah, you kind of have to, you do the work and then you wait around for a bit, hoping that people will give it a thumbs up. And then that waiting is sometimes long. And then when the thumbs up arrives, the work has to be done again very quickly.
Right. Well,
it's just kind of one of those things. I do love Only Murders in the Building. I was really glad to see that you were on that. That's that is one of the delights, one of the shows that has really kind of delighted me in recent years. So thank you for your work on that too.
Oh, no problem.
I love the book. I got to spend some time with it last month and it struck me. I don't know what kind of comparisons it's been getting. I don't know. I'm not very good at like reading about the books I'm reading or enjoying because I kind of just want to come to my own conclusions. But it did strike me as Stephen King's The Stand a bit, not only in scope and not only in length or the epic nature of it in terms of what it covered, but just the kind of the way that the sort of doom was balanced with a kind of hopefulness. And I just don't know how you spent this much time immersed in this specific work, a book that is about climate apocalypse, the ongoing, the very real climate apocalypse spanning decades. How did you come into the book? And then how did you come out of it emotionally, mentally, all of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a short answer. I'll try to be pithy. I just, as a young person, spent a lot of time looking at this situation and very, you know, quickly deciding that this was going to be, you know, not just one of the most important crises in human history, but also sort of the story of my lifetime. You know, David Wallace Wells, the writer, has this line about how most of the damage of the climate crisis has been done since Seinfeld was on the air, right? This is sort of very much the story that I've been watching as you know, I've progressed from a young person into an adult. And at some point I just, you know, sort of looked at the situation and saw that it's so far gone and so totally out of control that in order to turn things around, one of the great dramas of human history would have to unfold. And so as a storyteller, I just wanted to sort of imagine what that drama would be, you know, what kinds of people would rise to the moment and what forces would oppose them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm someone who kind of needs, you know, I'm doing a project right now that requires me kind of going through the archives of magazines through the 90s and seeing old Time or old Newsweek magazines where, you know, these stories about the climate were on the cover still.
Right.
And even earlier than that, it always confused me that this was seen as a present problem or a present urgency. Not only in the process of working on the book, but also talking about the book and living in the world that the book is, has been released into. Have you found yourself kind of, is there a balance between frustration and hopefulness? I find myself more frustrated in part because there are many people who believe that this is a new situation, and therefore once it gets presented or once the newness of it feels like it, you know, once it feels novel, then the clock kind of resets on what people's urgency is. And so I'm wondering where you, where you've landed on the frustration optimism scale, or if it's kind of just like a constantly ticking metronome.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, there were points during the process of writing this novel where I, you know, I genuinely did feel an awful lot of despair. A lot of 4 a.m. nights, wide awake, staring at the ceiling, because I, you know, I think the every single implication of it is just so frightening. And it's frightening in every single imaginable corner of our society and our world. And so I think that is, for me, the frustration comes in when people are sort of still, even not even not cognizant of it, but sort of don't feel the urgency of it. Like, obviously I feel a lot of urgency about it. And I think anybody who works on the issue feels a lot of urgency about it. But certainly even in, the course of the book tour, you know, I'd be talking to friends, you know, like having a drink afterwards or whatever. And they'd be sort of like, so is, you really think it's that bad? You know, I just sort of would have this moment of like wanting to shake them and be like, yes, of course I think it's that bad, you know? But at the same time, you know, I, in order to finish the novel, and sort of present the reader with, you know, create, see forward to what this crisis could become, and then present the reader with how the characters are reacting to it and how they're searching for a way out of it. In the course of writing that, you know, I did encounter sort of this keyhole that we can still squeeze through, right? This small path that still exists to extricate ourselves from this problem. And I think in looking at that and in spending so much time on it, I sort of was able to at least see the light at the end of this tunnel, you know, sort of see ahead. And that has given me what I guess I would call hope.
Yeah, it's also, I was overjoyed a bit by the humor in the book. Like, I don't think it's a, think it's a funny book. I don't, you know, I'm not like, ending it on a comedy night or whatever. But there is, I mean, this was in Ohio too. There's a way that you kind of weave humor into these narratives. And for a book that is long and requires a type of, although I will say for me it didn't feel as, it didn't feel however many pages, 900 or what have you. There's like a momentum to it that I think allowed me, at least I got through it in like 3 days, you know. I was on planes a lot, but still, you know, there was a momentum to it that made me kind of want to keep going. And a lot of that was kind of threaded together by at least what I thought were was like some humor, or at least a comic relief that kind of lives and breathes through some of the characters while not distracting from the reality that, you know, they are in peril, or the world they are in is perilous. Did you, I'm interested in this in part because, I mean, I write nonfiction. It is sometimes harder to inject humor as flawlessly and seamlessly throughout nonfiction. Was this a decision as you lived with and built these characters out? Was it a decision to kind of have these humor points, these flare points of humor, or did this just become, you know, like a thing where you could return to humor in the voice of some of the characters you'd built?
I think it's sort of a habit I come by naturally in my fiction writing, which is just that when, even when looking at, same in Ohio, even when looking at sort of the darkest subject matter and situations, you know, there is some gallows humor in everything, I guess. There is this way in which human beings react to even the darkest things with a joke. Right. And I just think, like, in trying to explicate the full range of our sort of bizarre human experience, it's almost impossible to do without humor, without sort of, you know, breaking the tension with, an odd moment of again, gallows humor, or, you know, even absurdity. I think I'm somebody who always appreciates a good random absurd joke in the middle of something otherwise pretty bleak. And a lot of my favorite writers will also do that use that technique. So I just think it's something I'm not even really conscious of or thinking about. It just sort of arises, but you're not the first person I've heard that from.
Good. You know, something that amazed me is just kind of the scope of your past two novels. You know, Ohio takes place in kind of a small container. It takes place over one night, I think. And this takes place over tens of years. And still, it, you know, Ohio's maybe more interesting to me in that approach, because after reading this book, I kind of went back and spent a little time with Ohio again. And I don't think anything is... you know, Ohio's a shorter book, but I don't think anything is kind of missed in terms of character development or fullness of narrative. Do you feel a difference writing into small containers in terms of linear time in the narrative, containers or having a more expansive container? Or does your approach not change in terms of how you flesh out a character arc or a story within a story?
Yeah, you know, it's... You know, both of these books are so complex narratively and structurally that I'm not sure I've learned anything from writing either one. Just because they presented their own bespoke problems in terms of weaving every one of these narrative threads together. I do think there's a way in which because Ohio was contained in one night, I could sort of diagram it out in my head very specifically. And I could sort of see where all the moving pieces were. And with the deluge, you know, I definitely had to break out the corkboard. And, you know, I became that Charlie Day meme where he's connecting all the yarn on the,
So, I know that meme.
So yeah, exactly. I think like all of us feel like that in our heads a lot of the time now, but, you know, I had to do a lot more sort of grunt work about how the narrative worked and how the dates were. You know, it like, as you said, it spans, 40 years. So even getting something as small as like Kate, the date of birth of Kate Morris's brother, you know, it's like you have to know that in order so it all lines up exactly right. And so like all those little elements became, you know, just such points of obsession, just to make sure everything connected. But so obviously a big task.
What's to kind of reverse it and talk a bit about Ohio. I know you no longer live in Ohio, but you were born here and were raised here.
It's Mount Vernon, a small town between Cleveland and Columbus, right? So and you're an Ohio guy, of course.
Yeah, I'm a Columbus guy. So you were near like Kenyon College and
correct,
and all of that. Were you as a young person? I just didn't grow up very. I grew up immersed in reading, but definitely not writing at all. Not at all. Were you writing at an early age, or were you kind of just consuming books at an early age?
Yeah, I mean, both. Parents are both professors. So I grew up in a house with a lot of books, of course, and started reading at an early age. And almost immediately, as soon as I learned to read, I was off writing my little stories, right? And I just think it's something I grew to enjoy so quickly, and I've been doing it so long that, I just have had so many reps at it. Because it is the thing I've like done consistently basically my entire life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a way that I think, I learned how to write just by being witness to stories in the oral tradition and stories on the page. And I see the tricks that I picked up from just having access to that as a young person and have get like getting a head start where my imagination was perhaps at its most sponge-like, if that's a thing.
Oh, I love, yeah, I love that expression. Yeah. It's almost like when you absorb some of that as a young person, you don't even know you're absorbing it, but it's, you know, you sort of, it feels so nice. It's such a like sort of a beautiful little glow inside of you that you just keep pursuing it, even when you don't really, you're not really sort of cognizant that you are.
When you kind of I love both the books, and I mostly want to talk about Ohio because it felt almost ekphrastic in a way, kind of book settling in into a not even crisis, but a world of a place that that you had access to, and I am really excited about this as someone who writes about place a lot, but I live in, I'm still in Ohio, and I write about Ohio from the standpoint of touchability, which is sometimes maybe not ideal, because even though I write nonfiction and poems, there's still, I see the realities of the world that I'm articulating, and so that maybe stifles some of the more whimsical approaches I can take, at least at first. What has it been like for you, kind of writing about a place or writing about a even in the deluge, like writing about a future that you cannot see? What kind of freedom, be it writing about a place that you're not physically in or a future that you cannot yet touch, does that kind of unlock a freedom for you in the way a story can evolve?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but that's, very well observed. I think with let's talk start with the future of the deluge. I on the one hand, I was working so hard to make sure it lined up and felt realistic to what's happening right now. Like that was a big point I spent a lot of time on, was making sure it felt like this future could arise from what we're seeing at this very moment, right? At the same time, it's just, this is my sandbox and I can do whatever I want in it. And there's something incredibly freeing about that to one's imagination. Similarly with Ohio, and I've said this before, it's like that the town of New Canaan is loosely based on the town I grew up in, but not really. It's an amalgamation of a lot of different towns in a particular part of Ohio. And why I needed to do that was to give myself the freedom to sort of paint whatever version of this town I needed in order to, make it work with the plot, make it work with all the characters. And so I do think you need, if you're writing fiction, you need to, sort of sever the cord between your absolute lived reality and what you need to do in this fictional world. Because once you start stitching yourself too closely to any particular what, place, setting, town, event, then you feel the need to be absolutely to treat it as real with total realism. And I think that sort of can upset the fiction writing process.
Another thing with the deluge is that I was actually surprised at how, speaking of things that upset the fiction writing process, I was surprised by how this did not upset, or at least did not appear to upset the book's trajectory at all. The detail in the book was fascinating because it is, while it is a fiction book, there were points of it where I was like, this is like a work of scientific nonfiction, or this is like a geopolitical analysis that is rubbing up against nonfiction, or an account of technology, or an account, there were all of these analyses that felt to me really rich and really weighty, but did not take away from the idea that I was reading a novel. It just kind of and didn't flow into what some would consider like a quote unquote hybrid text. And I am eager to hear about how you managed all of that. I guess how did you ju I know we talked about the like, being at the chalkboard thing, but how do you juggle? How did you manage to juggle this idea of weighty, fact-based, almost reporting, which I know you have history, you have some experience in that, but putting that into a novel form without damaging the fictional approach.
Right. It's, you know, it was always a careful balancing act, because what I wanted to do with the novel was not approach climate as allegory, not approach it as, you know, like pure dystopian, you know, the Cormac McCarthy, The Road type stuff. I wanted it to be a book about exactly our situation, with exactly the same institutions we're all familiar with, exactly the same things going on in our country, our society, our civilization that we're all familiar with. It had to be straight to the eye. This is what is happening. This is what the climate crisis is about, right? So that's my project I have in mind, except at the same time, I'm really cognizant through the whole process of being too didactic, and, you know, sort of sitting the reader down and just giving them a white paper on, you know, a situation. And so in order to sort of balance those two opposing, you know, ideas in my head, it's all about, for me, looking very specifically through the eyes of each character and trying to understand what they think, what they're reading, what they believe, and of course, what is, you know, sort of their foibles, their flaws, you know, how they are, what they're not seeing, what they're not able to access. And when you do that, you sort of can look at this enormous topic in a very specific way, but also in a very human way. And I think that was the key to me, was seeing through the eyes of a human being with all of their inherent sort of bullshit and fucked up-ness going on inside of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just a really rich human quality in the book. I will say that kind of, that is what I think perhaps propelled it for me, was wanting kind of be present, you know, present with the characters as they evolve. Do you consider this kind of I've read multiple or a few people who referred to this as like a horror, a work of horror. That was interesting to me because I didn't consider it such, and I know that it got praise for Stephen King, and I'm wondering if that has aligned some people or misaligned some people to it. But yeah, I'm interested if you view this as a work of horror at all.
I mean, the Stephen King thing could be responsible for that. I never thought of it as horror, although I did get that question in another interview recently, and I was like, oh, okay. I mean, certainly I have the intention of scaring people. Right. That is true. And so I can't deny that part of the book's project is to make people afraid of what's happening, because it seems to me insane that they're not. But at the same time, you know, the genre thing is always sort of odd, like calling it science fiction, I guess, is a technically accurate description, but I don't consider it that, or I didn't consider it that while writing it. And so I feel like the novel is sort of floating out there in the Venn diagram, if that makes any sense, somewhere in the middle of all those things.
Yes. That is kind of where I came down. I was like, there's a difference between like a work of horror and just something that is frightening, a reality that is frightening, you know?
Right.
And I actually began to feel like calling it horror did a disservice, in part because it would detach people from the realities of what is actually frightening. Like, you know, calling it horror maybe presents some, even though it is a fictional book, it presents an even greater fictional boundary between what the book is attempting. You know, like if the book is shouting and pointing at the sky, and people are like, well, I want to look up because that's scary, you know?
Yeah.
You definitely don't want that, I believe.
Go ahead. Oh, no, I was just going to say, I'm sure are aware of this. It's as soon as you let your book out into the world, you are faced with the prospect of people actually interpreting it. And there's that part of you that just wants to, like, run around everywhere, tapping everyone on the shoulder, being like, wait, no, that's not, you're not looking at this, right, you know, but you can't do that. And it's I think one of the great frustrations of writing, that you just sort of have to learn to let go, you know. It's that people are always going to interpret your work the way they want to, and the relationship between reader and writer is deeply asymmetrical, so.
And you can't control it, you know. That's the thing, that's the most perhaps frustrating thing. It can't be controlled, and so you're just kind of you are floating in the world, so to speak.
Yeah.
Lastly, or as we wind down, I really want to get some thoughts from you on two things. I'm just invested in your process because these books, Higher on the Deluge, they didn't come out that close to each other, but I am wondering, are you someone who works on two books at one time, or are you like a one book at a time writer? Which I am only asking because I'm imagining that the Deluge took so long to write that it had to have perhaps run into the work on Ohio.
Yep, you're absolutely right. I basically started both these books at the same time, probably around 2010. And I had finished maybe 40% of the Deluge and a draft of Ohio when Ohio sort of took over just because I'd gotten an agent for it. And suddenly it was time to like, okay, focus on this book, right? And so I set the Deluge aside and picked it back up, basically set it aside in maybe 2016 and picked it back up around 2018. And at that point, saw what I had on my hands and just was like, okay, let's get the first draft out, and spent the next 2 years just absolutely writing in a fever. And I'm talking like probably 1,000 pages for a total of 1,500 between 2018 and 2020. And the good thing is, when, I don't know if you feel this way, but it's like when a project takes over and sort of begins to, inhabit your mind in such a way that your entire sort of creative or intellectual vision comes down to this like very specific point. And it's this amount of focus that is like hard to it's hard to even describe, but just an amount of focus that really like takes over your life. And it's a little scary and totally awesome at the same time.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, I'm wondering how you are now that your book tour has winded down, how you're kind of finding pleasure in your own world, or how you're kind of building space for pleasure and comfort, or are you someone who's just like, I'm right back to work? Like, what are you doing outside of the work that that is bringing you some joy?
Well, I'm a big basketball fan.
Oh,
So
me
the NBA
too.
just has trade deadlines. So, oh, are you?
I'm like, I haven't been looking at my phone while we're talking, but we're in this like the kind of that era of the or that point of the trade deadline where everything happens even faster. And so I'm
That's
excited to look
right.
back down at my phone and see what teams are different now.
That's exactly right. I was like furious this morning when all the basketball podcasts hadn't updated yet. And I was like, well, what am I going to do today? Like, this is my whole day. So yeah, I mean, I'm a big hoops fan. But honestly, like getting back to work for me is kind of the joy. It's like the editing process is so intense. And then oh my God, I'm not an author anymore, and I'm a toaster salesman, and I have to go around and sell this toaster, this product. That is something that's deeply alien to, I think, most writers. And so just like, man, like getting up every day and drinking my coffee and sitting at my computer, and now I'm on a blank page situation. So like, just whatever insane idea I have is suddenly worth pursuing again, and that's just a great feeling. So I definitely am taking the time to sort of explore what I want to do next. And yeah, just trying to, I don't know how you feel, but like trying to capture a little bit of like, hey, I worked real hard at this thing. Maybe I should try to enjoy that fact that it's out and people are, emailing me and I'm doing interviews with smart people like you. It's like trying to enjoy a little of that is as impossible as that sounds.
Definitely. Are you? I gotta circle back and ask. Do you have a favorite team? Are you afraid? Do you have a favorite basketball team? NBA
Oh,
team?
Cavs for life. Cavs
Yeah,
for
I
life.
was. I assume, but didn't. Want to. I mean,
Yeah.
they're thrilling. This has been a thrilling season for the Cavs, and I think perhaps good news for them as the Eastern Conference has gotten a little bit weaker.
Oh, I was literally just texting my friend about that today. I was like, Nets are out of the way. It's good,
Yeah, I
so.
mean, Nets are. I don't think. I think they got it. They're going to be okay, perhaps. I think they'll still kind of squeak in the play in, but that kind of clears the space for the Cavs to get up there in the 3-4 range, and
Exactly.
we'll see how the rest shakes out.
Oh, I know. I'm so excited about this Mitchell, Mobley, Allen, Darius Garland. Like, this is a team I just love to root for. So I've been so excited this whole season about it.
And a good thing about the Cavs is, unlike a lot of teams, they have some long-term stability if they want it.
Totally.
A lot of teams, it's kind of like, well, we got these guys for this tiny bit of window, and somebody's going to want to trade or something.
Exactly.
We're not going to be able to afford them. Cavs kind of have a window for a while if they want to. They're going to have to kind of maybe finagle some money to get the Mobley extension working. But it's incredible. It's been fun to watch them. They've been one of the most fun teams this year, and I hope they kind of continue their march to the top, one of those top three spots in the East.
Absolutely. And just they play with a lot of joy. I think, like, you know, like, don't get me wrong, like, those LeBron teams of the last few of the 2010s, like, I basically watched as many games as I possibly could, but it was always like, you know, my heart was always in my throat about it. I was always like, there's always some drama going on. It's always like terrifying that the whole thing, Endeavor's going to collapse. And now this team just feels like so fluid and like they're having a bunch of fun with each other. So
yeah,
it's been really cool.
Well, I am going to be rooting for the Cavs on your behalf, and thank you for this wonderful book, and thank you for all your writing. I'm a big fan, and thank you for talking to me.
Oh, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you having me on.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys, but before I do that, I wanted to let you guys know about a special live Small Joys coming up on May 30th. My guest will be the incredible artist Regan Buchanan, and we'll talk about the release of her new comic book, The Secret History of Black Punk, which is stunning, and I'm not just saying that because I'm in it, and we'll talk about much more. To reserve your spot, go to wosu.org/events. Hope to see you there. So this week, my small joy involves the flowers growing back in my yard. I know so much of this has been seasonal, but as I said last time, you know, like we're spring is a really brief season here, but my spring is often defined by the roses and flowers growing back in my yard. I'm not really much of a gardener. I don't tend to my yard very well, and these things are like perennials that just grow back. And that in and of itself fascinates me, the fact that every year, with me doing very, very little to seduce them out of the earth, beauty just grows out of the ground. And then when it is prepared, when it's done with us, it kind of shrinks away and then rests. And so it's kind of like when I look outside in winter and it's dreadful and cold and gray and getting dark early, I kind of remember, and I'm kind of propelled by this idea that even underneath the dark, cold, gray of it all, there is kind of beauty waiting to bloom. And that makes the rewards of the blooming all the more exciting for me. And so right now, there are some roses growing along the side of my house that do come back every spring. I do have to, like, I water and, you know, do some landscaping around them. But then in the very front of my house, they're like the smallest kind of white perennials are beginning to bloom. And I think perhaps by June, they'll be in full swing, and they're white and red and kind of alternating colors. So there's like one white flower, one red, one white, one red. And that's just kind of like how they came. They surprisingly, weirdly, not weirdly, I'm 100% sure that whoever lived here before me did this intentionally, but they matched my house. They matched the color of my house. And so that's also really delightful. I'm a big flower person. I get flowers for myself every other week that I'm not traveling, so I can take care of them and put them in the house. And so it's good to have some beauty kind of encircling the house as well. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis. Sound engineering by Eric French. Nick Hauser is the Chief Content Director of Digital Media. Thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll be back next week with more Small Joys.